My name is Chris Main, M-E-I-N, and I'm with Commander G.B. Barnes, B-A-R-N-E-S, and we're at Commander Barnes' home on Barnes Road, 1147 Barnes Road, Crofton, British Columbia, and we're with Dr. R.H. Roy, Professor of Military History and Strategic Studies at the University of Victoria, and the date today is 25 July 1979.
Let me ask you, first off, is there any connection between your name and the name of the road?
Yeah, we came here when there wasn't any road. My grandfather, Captain Barclay, lived at Westholm, and he was the one who discovered Barclay Sound. Mrs. Hill has all that tape.
Yeah.
Anyway, when he died, we sold that place and moved here. The smelter just packed up, man. There was only a trail there or a rowboat, and we cleared all this.
Oh, bless my soul.
Yeah, and then, I left, joined the Naval College, beginning of the war.
Well, you were born here?
No, I was born at Work Point Barracks.
Oh, I see.
When my people were there.
I see.
1898.
Now, about Captain Barclay, you said a Mrs. Hill?
Mrs. Hill on Salt Spring.
Yes.
She maintained... This Mrs. Barclay, well, it's quite a long story. Captain Barclay was commissioned by some of the members of the East India Company in England on the sly to go to Ostend and come out here to sea otter trade, you see.
Mm-hmm.
1787, I think it was.
Right.
And they changed the colors to Austrian flag.
Yeah.
And he married the daughter of the parson there. And only 17, and she accompanied him on this trip, and it's really a wonderful experience. She wrote a diary all the way around.
Did she?
And that is the one that Mrs. Hill think was not destroyed in the fire at my grandfather's house when it caught fire in 1910, I think it was. And she thinks it's in England. She went out, spent a whole summer looking around England for it and couldn't find it.
For the diary?
Hmm?
Looking for the diary.
Yeah.
What a shame.
I'm sure it was burnt there.
Yeah.
And anyway, she still thinks it is. I'm pretty sure it wasn't, because my mother, we lived with him. He moved out of the house we were in, built a little house himself,
mm-hmm.
only about 400 or 500 yards away, and mm-hmm. she saw him all the time there. Anyway, that's what she thinks, and she sticks to it, but...
Yeah. Well, then your father would be born in this area rather than you.
No, my father's born in England. He's in the Royal Marine Artillery.
Uh-huh.
Away back. He was the same time as Admiral Jellicoe and admirals of that vintage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because he was at Woolwich, I think it was, with them doing courses.
That'd be back in the 1870s, 1880s.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Right.
And that story will tell you later on, in that printed thing there, I'll tell you quite a bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a caricature, I've seen it in Whale Island, the gunnery school in Portsmouth,
mm-hmm.
of an old-time rugby team, and the heads are recognizable, but the bodies and
right.
things are in, you know, funny attitudes in,
right.
in a scrum there.
Right.
And one of them you can recognize as Jellicoe there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, anyway, he knew all these people around that time. He knew Craddock, too,
mm-hmm.
I think. Yeah.
Did he leave any diaries or letters or anything of that nature?
No.
He didn't?
No,
I
didn't know even
know. So you were born yourself then in England at what?
At Work Point Barracks, when my father was there in the submarine mining business, they laid loop mines around the entrance to Esquimalt.
And he would be working for the Royal Marine Artillery.
He was there.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of history books here written about that.
Mm-hmm.
One.
What was the date of your birth, by the way?
December 13th, 98.
98.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, your first memories would be... presumably of the Work Point Barrack area.
Well, I was too young then, but... Well, anyways, I know, when I was 11 months old, the Marine Detachment were called back to go to South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And I left with my mother and father and went over by train, and he went to South Africa, and the Marines in the railway transport there.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a little pom-pom thing there. That's a siege of Mafeking, I think it was.
Oh, for heaven's sake, is that right?
Yeah. And he got enteric fever there, came mm-hmm. back, and that affected him afterwards. He was never really well after that.
He came back to where?
I came back to England, and he was given an appointment in Montrose in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
It had a Royal Marine barracks there.
Oh, I see.
And I don't think. But one funny thing, they had recruits from the Hebrides Islands came to this barracks for training. And these fellows, when they landed, they'd never seen a train before. When the train came in, they got the wind up. And I remember them coming to the barracks on the parade ground there, a lot of sand dunes in behind Montrose there. And I used to go down and stand easy and talk to these fellows. See, and I'd make a grass bird's nest. And I said, what's the Gaelic for this? And so on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after that, we went down to Portsmouth. And
when would that be? Have you any idea?
19.
How old would you be roughly? Just roughly.
I was about 5 years old, I think.
Yeah.
We went to Portsmouth, and I've got pictures of them at Eastney Barracks there, and we came out. He retired, I think it was. We came out about 1906 to stay with my mother's people, Captain Barclay in Westholme.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see.
And we landed in Victoria, and I remember we were driven in a buggy from, there were no cars up here then around mm-hmm. then, driven in a buggy from the station at Westholme to my grandfather's house. I remember asking questions, you know, I didn't know anything about names of trees out here, that sort of thing. And then about 1909 or 10, my grandfather built this little house, and he moved over into that by himself,
mm-hmm.
and where he had these documents,
mm-hmm.
these diaries and things.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, we moved to Crofton here, and we stayed here. And that was when my father got interested in the Navy Leagues with Salt Spring here.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
did he build this house, your father?
Yeah, we had this house built. It cost $2,500 in those days.
Yeah. Yes, I can imagine it
would. Not insulated.
Yeah.
No, I slept upstairs and had a little round oil heater thing, you know.
Yeah.
I'd hang my shirt over this in the winter and hop out of bed.
Well, at that time, there'd be very few houses around here and no roads.
There was only one up here. And later on, Hyde Parker came next door here, and Foster, and they started Croft Motorboat Works here.
Mm.
And they hauled all the lumber up the beach from Chemainus here, and Scott hauled it up the bank here. Then we tried to get water. Somebody was buying water out here, and we went down 60 feet and no water and clay. So we put a pipeline in, we had to the stream up here.
Yeah.
And that's exceedingly valuable now. It's the best water around here, and we're not on this public system, which is going to cost people a fortune, anybody who's on it,
mm-hmm.
this well drilling thing. And that is one of the things I think the people outfitted want for this place here, Arlene Gather. They want water rights.
Yeah.
But Miss Renimo realty that are discussing this with us. Mm-hmm. But don't let on at all. We haven't.
I just hope you have a good lawyer, by the way.
Well, yes, there's one in Duncan there who, see, my wife is in the horse business, and his stenographer is one of her people. She's got organizing the shows and things.
Yeah.
So, and she says that he is interested in people like us who need help, and he can't be swayed by more money somewhere else.
Good.
Coleman, is it? Coleman, I think.
Yes, I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
That's right. Yeah,
I've heard of him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right.
So
you grew up here as a young boy then. What about schooling?
I went to the school, first of all, I went to university school, the lower school Mr. Bolton ran on Belcher Avenue. That ran between the Willows Road and Jubilee Hospital grounds.
Yeah.
And there were just a few of us there, and he is the youngest boys of all. And I think I got a summer as I received the grand pocket money of 5 cents a week. We used to go downtown and see how many candies we get for 5 cents. My uncle came down once and he gave me 50 cents, and I was so struck by this that I buried it in a tin can and put four grand.
Oh, my word. Lovely. Lovely.
Well, then, I think, oh, golly. Though the Chinaman used to work there for Bolton, Mr. Bolton, and I was being made the butt of the other kids over this. There's a little fence, and there's an outhouse near the back of the house, and they egged me on to go and yell at this Chinaman, "Chin Hai Bao Shi," whatever that meant, but it certainly wasn't complimentary, because afterwards the Chinaman rushed out and grabbed me and took me and shoved my head in the open outhouse outside till I yelled. Well, then we moved to the middle school, which is near where Government House is now. It was up on the rocks looking over the hollow down below, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And golly, we had a terrible time there, small kids. Fellow named Duncan Inverarity, and we thought he was a bully. He had an army of about three or four kids, a little older, and the rock came like this down into a crevice,
mm-hmm.
and he put us in there and shut it all off and lit a fire in there. He said, "Now, you've got to learn to be like Indians and live in smoke." And he smoked us out after. Then he had another trick. The rock went down in an oak tree. He put a rope around this and around your neck and just sort of pushed you off, swung you off. Don't know how he didn't break our neck.
Who was doing this?
This fellow in Verarity.
Was he a student?
Yeah, he was older than we were.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Just and boyish fun.
Yeah. And there's another fellow there named, these people were in the flower business in Duncan, in Victoria. He was a wonderful chap. And he wasn't afraid of Duncan, and so he stopped this. And I remember he and Duncan had a fist fight, and we were all secretly cheering for Woodward, his name was. Woodward Flores. And I don't think either won, but sort of had a pact after that. Well, then Duncan had an army. And I used to hide in the basement and look through a knothole. And he had a board outside with a lot of nails sticking up. And his army would grab young fellows and dunk him on this to be able to stand. All this sort of thing. Well, anyway.
The school of hard knocks.
Anyway, eventually went to England, and after this story here, came back on leave. Then I went over again.
Now, you're going over as a student?
This is quite a long time afterwards.
Oh, I see.
And eventually we went into this camp, Borley Camp near Aldershot. They called up all the reserves, and there were five battalions there, Fleet Reserve. They were all stokers and in civilian life, so they had them segregated. They didn't want to get them up against their own people, see, and we stayed there. Well, I was in the 5th Portsmouth Battalion. Well, a chap named Crewe in my term, he said, oh, do you know Duncan Inverarity is staying near here in the Hussars, and he'd like to see us. And I went over there and saw him. Holy smoke, he changed. You know, when I was a kid, I thought he was a big fellow. He was about this size to me.
But you spent most of your schooling then. You took most of your schooling at a private school in Victoria.
Well, after that, I came up to Duncan here, this Scrimshire's school.
After which?
After the university, after all these things went on down there, I couldn't stand any longer. See, I told my people, they got me up here.
Oh, yeah.
And this little school put in quite a lot of people into the Navy. One of them was this Maitland Dougal. And Phil Livingston, the eye specialist, you know, went there, and others. They were the big boys.
This is at university school?
No, this is this Scrimshire's private school.
Oh, here?
Yeah, and it was financed by parents of people around here.
Oh, I see.
And we had nothing there. We had supposed to be a gym, it was a big barn, and it had an earth floor, and the only equipment in it was a rope my father donated was hung down from the ceiling. Well, this is the sort of things we brought up. We, you know, not all this fancy stuff these kids have.
Yeah.
And it was from there that I took my entrance exam.
Well, now, at the school here,
yeah.
How many years did you go through there?
Scrimshire's?
No, yes.
I think about 2, maybe. Yeah, probably. One thing I hated was Latin. I had came home here weekends, had Latin, and Scummy used to get after me because I went through it too fast and I didn't remember the beginning, you see. Always threatening me on this. So when this thing came along about the Naval College, I thought, my gosh, here's a chance to get away from Latin. That was one of the maybe go in. The other one was Nathan Dougal. And Donald from, he died in Sydney or in Sanish quite a few years ago, was in my term class. He and I took the exams together down in Victoria, and I've got this in here.
Excuse me just for a minute. How old would you be at this time?
About 15. I joined the college when I was 15 and a half. I was just over 15.
Right.
And we went down there, and we put in with a building somewhere around where the old post office used to be. But we were kicked out of there when some civil service exams, they wanted a room for them. Mm-hmm. So they sent us to Chinatown, Fiskard Street, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And we had to take the exams there with Chinese music going on next door. And I said in this thing here, it was very hard to concentrate for that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we came home here and waited the results.
Well, can I interrupt at this point? You've had only 1 or 2 years at school in Victoria, and only 1 or 2 years at school here in Duncan?
I think so, yeah. But, this middle school in Victoria, see, we went to junior small boys school at Bolton Round, Belcher Avenue. After that, we went to the middle school.
Oh, I see.
Near Government House there. It's, I don't know how long I was there, maybe a couple of years. And,
yeah.
In 1914, is that correct, sir?
Hmm?
In the early part of 1914, when you decided to join the Royal Naval College of Canada?
Yes. Let me think. I get rattled over this. I took the exams in May 1914.
Mm-hmm.
And we came back home here to wait for the results. And,
do you recall the types of questions on the exam? Was it general knowledge as opposed to special, like, trigonometry and things like that?
Yeah, it was a pretty easy exam, really. I've forgotten what there was in it now. Well, we came back here, and Donald's results came through first. And I think he placed fourth, and nothing happened but mine at all. And Scripture started to get after me and said, I told you, should have worked harder. And scowled on me, you know, and all that stuff. And I went around my tail down. And mine came through, and I passed first.
Oh,
I had to laugh on him.
Love
it. Yeah. And then we were told to join the Naval College 1st of August, 1914. And there I go on with my trip across Canada, you know, and we had to go tourist, and, you know, they had a kitchen one end of the car, and people cooked their meals there, and the dust was terrible on the prairies. Satin. All these kids in the kitchen here come along, and you go to sleep in the seat, and they wipe jammy fingers on your face, and there's so much dust that when he went to the washroom basin was full of sand, too. You couldn't get clean. And we eventually arrived in Montreal. My father had friends there, and they met him there. And the first thing he did was take us down to the bars down below and get a good bath.
Scrub you up.
Yeah.
Now your transportation, your father would pay for that.
Yeah, we had to pay for that, yeah.
The Naval College in Canada would not pay to get you...
Not the first time, as far as I remember, we had to pay. Well, then... my father knew the director of studies, Commander Hartley, name was, director of studies there. Mm-hmm. And we stayed with him for 2 or 3 days because the whole college hadn't opened. And then I remember him coming to me and said, you've got to shave. And I had a little sort of whisker, you know. I was ashamed of having to shave. I didn't do it. And then he came on, really got after me after that.
Oh, yeah.
Then I went over and joined. And... we had to have a kit to take over. We bought here before we went over, mostly flannels, white flannels, and shirts and things like that. And when we got there, we found that the tailors in Halifax were too taken up making army uniforms. They couldn't do anything for us at all for quite a while. And we used to wear floppy white hats. And I've got a very good photograph there in front of the Naval College building, the steps down, the flower beds around by it, beautiful building. And there were 2 brass cannon either side of the entrance steps. And the new kid cadets, first thing they did was get each other to snap their photographs astride of these, you see, with these hats on.
And
eventually we got... and the first time there we had to wear... stiff shirts, like peacetime routine.
Mm-hmm.
Stiff shirts down to the engine room, engineering workshops, too. But they soon dropped that because the washing facilities in Halifax couldn't contend with all this. And from there on, then, after about a year, I think, we got blue monkey jackets. And lanyard. We wore a lanyard to keep our keys of our sea chest on.
Now you're at the Naval College in Halifax.
Halifax, yeah.
At this moment, yeah.
Yeah, about the first year of the war.
Yeah.
And the old Niobe was alongside. And they said she rested on bottles and tin cans there.
Yeah.
You know, just before the war, like the rainbow here, and that it was criminal the way. Canada wouldn't keep them up at all, and the morale in the Navy was nil. I remember Commander Navy coming down afterwards and talking to Hose, Commodore Hose, about it. He said, oh, it's awful. Well, anyway, they got her afloat, and the commissioner was Newfoundlanders. And I remember... they had a cutter race in Bedford Basin, 3 miles long, with a British cruiser that was there. And these Newfoundlanders just walked right away from them. Hell of a stroke, rowing all their knives.
I'll bet they were. Well, how long were you at the Naval College?
Well, we got out early. We got out in 2.5 years. 1940, we got out, we took our passing out exam, graduating exams, December 1916.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where they were niggardly again. They wouldn't promote us to midshipman until the 2nd of February when we joined the Leviathan in Bermuda.
Mm-hmm.
And they saved themselves some money over that, I suppose. That was when our seniority started as midshipman.
I see.
Commander Nixon, was it? Would he be the...
Commander Nixon was the commander of the college. Yeah, he was the executive officer.
Did you have any relations with him at all during this time?
Oh, yes. see, my people went to England, and I think it was the last term there. I had nowhere to go during the holidays. And Commander Nixon married... His wife was, I've forgotten her name now, lived in the Isle of Orleans. They were very well off, had a place in the Isle of Orleans. And she said she'd take me there for 6 weeks or so. And then I went up and boarded in Quebec City. And I was made honorary member of the Garrison Officers Club there. And they used to call me the Admiral. And we had one or two trips out. Oh, yes. Then... I boarded with McPherson, Mr. McPherson, I've got his first name. He was a financial man. He used to go up to Montreal every day, every week anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
And his niece, who was older than I was, Vita McPherson, was very nice to me, and she introduced me to a lot of people there. And she said, oh, we're going to have a dance at the Chateau Saturday night or sometime it was, and you can come along. So I was scared of girls. I never met any out here. I was scared stiff of them, you know. And I didn't dance, and I felt awful. Anyway, I went there, and the ladies all went to the powder room to fix themselves up. people coming in, I was standing there, cadet uniform, you see, and bum freezes, his short jacket. And people coming in handed me their tickets. When they arrived, I had a fistful of tickets. Anyway, I couldn't dance, but they tried to teach me. After that, we went on a... From there, we went to Montmorency Falls. And, oh yeah, and we had sleighs drove there, and I've forgotten what happened about these sleighs. We passed one of them, the farmer's sleighs, I think they were. Somebody, I think, pulled a bag of something out of the back of one of these sleighs, and it made them mad. They chased us. We got to a place where there was a what do you call it? You had to stop there.
Oh, a toll gate?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we got there and went through, and then these fellows came through. However, we led them on until we got near Montmorency, and then we stopped and gave them something for it, just for fun. This was sort of a fun thing. Then we went up, and they had a dive space in there, which I was terrified of. And they had a big sleigh thing built up on wood here, and only that wide, with ice either side. And you had a little one-person sleigh with runners.
Oh, yeah.
And you get up there, and you wheel down to the other side, and you climb up steps and come back. And each chap had a girl with him, like this. You went two to a sleigh. And I liked that quite a lot, but... when we came back to Hamilton Dance,
yeah, yeah. Well, let me get back to Halifax for a moment. You're there for
two and a half years.
Two and a half years. By the time you graduate, you're a midshipman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the war has been going on, it's now about, what, 1916, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, it's 2.5 years.
Yeah. And you're then posted to a British ship, I think.
Yeah, the Leviathan. She's the flagship in Bermuda.
Did you request that, or...?
No, that was arranged by Ottawa. And...
it would be February 2nd, 1917, according to my notes.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember going down the Chignecto, the RMSP Royal Mail steamship packet there. I felt damn seasick. I couldn't get out of my bunk. And whenever I got vertical, I was sick.
Oh, dear.
And the Gulf Stream there, rough as hell. However, after a couple of days, I managed to get on deck and I was all right.
Mm-hmm.
But I got all this down here.
Yes,
in that story.
That's in this document here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. The document carries you through your cadet years, does it, or how far does that cover?
It covers us till the end of the war, and afterwards the French government treated 500 officers and 1,300 men to 6 days in Paris, and we cut lots in the gunroom, and the first cut, some RN Mitchman cut one, but he hadn't passed his exams then, so he was told he had to stay behind. They cut again, and Creary and I won. Creary was a fellow of my term. And, oh boy, what do you think? We landed at Cherbourg, and all the way up to Paris, champagne in your hand, all the way up there. We met by a French band there, and I think they played the wrong tune, I'm not sure.
What date would this be, roughly?
This is April 1919.
Oh, I see. I see.
And
well, I wonder if we could. I don't want to repeat what Tom said here, but just if you could give us a brief account of the First World War experiences. For example, you're posted to the Leviathan. What sort of a ship was it?
Well, she was a big cruiser, antiquated though.
Uh-huh.
And Murray, who was CNC Halifax, you know. Northwest Atlantic was a lieutenant, acting lieutenant there, I think,
mm-hmm.
And he was very good to us. He saw that we more or less helped us with all these customs and things that we.
Mm-hmm.
I got a picture of him calling ship there.
Mm-hmm.
Would your Canadian Naval College training stand you in good stead as a midshipman? In comparison, say, with the midshipmen coming
well,
from Granite?
Well, you had extremely good training in the subjects they taught there, but they'd never been to sea. They didn't know the customs. And we got sent on all kinds of crazy errands, you know. Go and fetch the starboard watch. You thought it was a watch, you see. And go to the boatswain's mate or some petty officer or something, and he can give you poor fool. He knew what was going on.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. Bucket of steam, check paint. And,
yeah.
I'm thinking, so you were at a disadvantage then with the English midshipmen, with sea time and other courses, I guess.
Well, the English midshipmen, they've been sent to sea. They skipped Dartmouth a lot, I think, and some of them were sent straight from Osborne was a junior college, you see,
mm-hmm.
And Dartmouth was the next one,
mm-hmm.
higher up. And these fellows, in some of the ships that came into Halifax there, the Glory was one, Caesar, they hadn't been to sea at all, were sent to sea early. And after the war, they had to go back to Cambridge. They had 6 months at Cambridge to get their education. And when we went to Minotaur, they'd been sent earlier, but we were way ahead of them in navigation. And during the time, we had this naval instructor sent with us, Cyclops' nickname, Alan. He's a hell of a good chap, and made us take all our peacetime sights required in peacetime for the rank of lieutenant while we're in the rocks in the tropics pretty well. After that, in the Minotaur, you never got any sights at all. It was mostly bad weather and fog and stuff. And, the turning point, the danger point was, we took these convoys to, I think it was Trondheim. Because I know there's a big lighthouse on a rock outside the fjord, and the full convoys, they had pit props for the coal mines in England mostly. They sailed out, and you can see the smoke coming down here, and we buzzed around. We did this regularly every couple of weeks outside, and the destroyers, I got photographs there, made smoke screens, and we dropped smoke boxes. There were submarines stationed there all the time. And I got Von Schier's thing about it too.
Well, according to my records here, you joined the Leviathan. I'm sorry, how do you pronounce it?
Leviathan.
Leviathan,
yeah.
Thank you. And in Jamaica, and you went on a couple of sweeps looking for Van Buchner's Raiders.
Yeah. No, we joined the Leviathan in Bermuda.
In Bermuda.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we took passage down in a ship called the Carnarvon to Kingston, Jamaica, and we joined the Roxburgh there, and they were coaling, and the way they coaled there, I got women's lib, the coal was brought on from the coaling jetty up the gangway by women in baskets on their heads, and, and mostly, some men too, I think.
So you went on some, what, sweep looking for German...
No, yeah, that was not from Bermuda. After that, we came up to... that was not in Jamaica, I mean. We came up to Bermuda,
mm-hmm.
and we did this refit in a dry dock, and we went to the marine... Marines, we went with the Marines to the... they had a firing range and so on there. We had this major Marines in charge of us, and we dug trenches and cooked our own meals, and it was always full of sand and wind blowing. And a few pleasures like that. And then we went back, and the ship had come out of dry dock then, and the ship had anchored along the north shore of Bermuda, a little place there now. And we were sent ashore for recreation there just for a few hours. And she was just lying opposite, anchored. And we got a sudden recall, and we saw another British cruiser, Donegal, I think it was, steaming by. And we had to up anchor and steam out too. And they made a line abreast in visibility distance to sweep right down outside the West Indies for Von Lechner, who had this raider, you know, and the story about that was very interesting. Anyway, he had a captain's club on board. He's damn good at these people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a picture of him at his table, and all the captains of the ships captured were sitting opposite Von Lechner. He was this side, all quaffing champagne. The last ship they captured had cargo champagne.
Have you ever read the book called The Sea Devil that he wrote himself?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very it's a very interesting, but in any event, you never got him.
No.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, sir, but then when you left there, you went to the United States for convoy.
Well, after, he sent these 400 prisoners under a British captain that he trusted, made him promise on his oath he would avoid contacting anything till he landed them in Brazil somewhere, I think it was. And but that gave him time, and by the time the news got back, the Admiralty's around the horn of the Pacific. And that's what happened. And then we were ordered, the Roxburgh alone, ordered to New York. And we went up there, and we went in there, I got this story in there. We passed the Vaterland, she was the biggest German liner interned over in Hoboken, which is a German shipping side, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We anchored up the river there. And what it was for, Lord, I've forgotten his name now, it's in the story, had been sent over by the British to tell the Americans what help they wanted in the Atlantic, and especially on the British side in it. And that was all arranged, and we were flat broke by this time. And we went down to Hampton Roads, where these convoys were going to assemble. And we got down there, and we were steaming past Cape Henry, the entrance, towards Point Comfort, which was where we anchored. And we suddenly saw a tug coming foaming towards us and sounding you on a siren. You were standing in the danger. So we stopped, and tug came up and said, "You're standing in one of our minefields we just laid." Oh, God. Got out of there. And, well, I don't know whether they communicated to the Admiralty and there hadn't been time to get it to us, or, you know, like the beginning of this war, they weren't used to wartime routine.
Yeah.
And the coordination was not very good.
May and June 1917, you bought two convoys from Chesapeake Bay to Devonport.
Yeah.
If you recall what they were like, sir.
Oh, yeah, that's all in there, too. But, well, we had no refrigeration in those days. We were on bully beef. No, we were on first provisions for about 2 or 3 days, I think, and then on bully beef of one kind or another all the way over. But when we got to the south of Ireland, when we got to 40 West, I think it was, we were met by a whole swarm of destroyers who came out there, and they took over the convoy, and they buzzed around them, and we buzzed up the English Channel. But we went through this south of Ireland wreckage, and as far as you could see, every direction of floating wreckage there. And that was where they concentrated. And in Jellicoe's book, he said, this was a crisis of the naval war. If it had gone on for another short time, England would have been starved. That's true. And, well, we went up the channel. And, you know, we were crazy. We were hoping we'd be torpedoed to see what it looked like. We were looking over the side. And our PMO, he had five geese waistcoats, I think, one for the sick bay, one for some other place, or it'd be one for the heads, wherever he was. And we got opposite Falmouth, somewhere around there, and we saw a U-boat chasing a small British freighter and firing shells at her on the surface, and the freighter was returning the fire. Oh, we buzzed on, there's nothing to do with us. So we got into Devonport all right, and we stayed there in cold. Not very long, and then we came out to go back, and we didn't have a convoy going back at all. We made pretty fast speed, about 18 knots all the way across, and picked up a second convoy.
Can I interrupt here for a moment? What is your job on board ship at this time?
Midshipman?
Yeah, you're still a midshipman at this time.
Yeah. Well,
do you have any particular duties as midshipman?
Oh, yeah. In the Roxbury, we took watches and lookout up top to look out for smoke on the rise or anything like that, or torpedoes. I've forgotten what mine was. Then you had the ordinary midshipman to watch. You had to read the log and all that sort of thing every 4 hours. And had your gunnery stations at action station. But when we got the Minotaur, she was an old cruiser being flagship on the China station. She had most of the same crew they had in the China station. And she was surveyed in Camel Ledge, in the Mersey, and she was given 4 minutes to remain afloat if she was torpedoed between the masts because of the size of the engine and boiler rooms, you see, all in one piece there, and go down like a stone. Well, Curry and I, our action station was in the transmitting station, the TS it's called, with the bandsman down there, and what we did was the gunnery officer was up in the foretop, and he had his Battenberg, which calculated the, estimate the course of the enemy, you see, and from that it would give you the rate of change of range and bearing, too. Well, we had a plot down below, and anybody seeing that plot now would have a heck of a laugh. I was supposed to listen. I had two earphones coming. We had three range finders, and they all passed as soon as they could take ranges. And I called these out, and we had a piece of paper, this plot, and the stopwatch went in one revolution. It was so many yards, you see, I think it was. And I called out the ranges as they came down and query plotted these, and from the angle he could get what the range should be if the range finders were correct, actual range, you see, instead of the estimated range. And also any change in range, if they altered course, to help the gunnery officer up top. And this damn thing, we were below the armored deck, and the action stations, there were 400 men below the armored deck, because it included the loading stations for the 7.5 turrets, five aside, and the what we have now, and the engine room, people think. And we were all locked down in there. There was a square hatch, which was clips tight all around, and the only exit was a manhole. And, you know, how many people get out of that in a hurry?
Lock you down there.
Huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this one time when we sighted this cruiser again in there, and steaming parallel to us, it was after being in there, the German bite there, and she was making smoke, and we challenged her, and nothing doing, we challenged her time again, nothing doing, and we were just going to open fire, when I think she altered course or something, and the smoke cleared. We channeled her with a 10-inch flash lamp, you see, signal lamp. Smoke cleared, and it was one of our own, the Royalist. It just got a little far.
I'll be damned.
Yeah.
Well, after your convoy duty here, you state that, what, 8 Canadian midshipmen were appointed to the HMS Minotaur.
Mm-hmm.
And based at Scapa Flow.
Yeah.
To be in, what, July
1917? No, that was in April, after we left the Roxbury, we joined the Minotaur in Liverpool.